Son.
Hello. There we go. Anyone here new this week and hasn't been here in weeks past? Okay. Ah, welcome. So, for that couple, we are, I can no longer say in the midst of, we are finishing a six-week course on addictions from a Christian perspective. And I'm excited about today. I think this is going to be, I was sharing with some earlier, this is going to be our best class, I think. So you didn't miss anything previously. And just a reminder, some have asked for the slide deck, and I've provided that via email. So if you want prior sessions. Now, the slides that you'll see later, we're going to have several revisions to these. But regardless, if you want those, just email me. So to quickly review, we don't have to go through all the different weeks, but last week, week five, we talked about process addictions, you'll recall, and that was mostly with an attention to sexual addiction. And this week, we conclude with the summary, kind of wrap it all up. And as I was doing some reading this week, I came across some scriptures that that I thought nicely will help us to summarize this topic. So we'll be looking at Jeremiah 2 and 2 Chronicles 20. Those will be our key scripture passages. So on to a quiz. First question is this. The Latin verb, I'll spell it for you, A-D-D-I-C-E-R-E, from which the English word addiction is derived. This is true or false. Did I say that? That verb primarily means to enslave or give oneself over to someone or something. True or false?
True.
Thank you. Second question. The two general types or categories of addictions are substance addictions and practical addictions. True or false? False. Trying to trick you up there or trip you up on the word practical. It's actually process addictions is the term you'll hear. But that's trivial. Next question. All addictions involve good gifts of God that are distorted to become idolatrous ends in themselves. True or false? You're right on it. True. And finally, the Christian organization that most directly influenced the early formation of Alcoholics Anonymous was the Oxford Group.
True.
And then I'm going to throw out some discussion questions now. We'll come back to them in the latter half of the class, okay? Here are the questions. Just kind of be mulling these over in your mind as I'm speaking. Ah, the AV crew. Let's give it up for the Darbys. Yay! Okay. So here's question one. As a result of your attendance in these classes, has your understanding of the factors that contribute to addictions changed? Now, don't answer that now. We'll come back to that. And what are some of the predisposing factors? Second question for discussion later, has your attitude towards the addict changed? And, you know, better than just yes or no, you know, in what way? Third question, does the emphasis primarily from the scientific community on addictions as a brain disease detract from the personal responsibility of the addict? And a few more questions. We may not get to all of these, but it's kind of pick and choose. What role ought the church play in ministering to addicts? What role do prayer and worship play in healing from an addiction? And when is it appropriate, if at all, to speak of an addict as being cured or healed? And if you have any other questions you want to offer, you'll have a chance later to do that. Okay, so as I was thinking, okay, how do we wrap this topic up? I thought it best to not do more of the science. That's all boring. So to share with you some theological insights, not my own. I have nothing original to bring to this topic, so I admit complete plagiarism here. And I will let you know where these thoughts come from. We'll look at some Christian authors. This would be the extra scriptural sources, if you will. First, we'll briefly look at a sermon by Thomas Chalmers and G.K. Chesterton, British author. He has an interesting quote. C.S. Lewis, we'll look at a quote from his, from him. And then a contemporary of ours, a fellow Michael Cusick, I think I'm pronouncing that right. He lives in Colorado. He's a pastor, well, a minister. I don't know if he pastors, but and he's a counselor primarily. And he's just published a very interesting book that I'll talk a little about. So those are the extra scriptural sources from which we will derive our nuggets, if you will. And then we're going to look at two scripture passages. First, from a king of Judah, happens to be the fourth king of Judah. I verified that this morning. Have you ever been up in the library? They have this elaborate timeline. Yeah. And I sat down there and I looked up and I go, whoa. You know, from Adam down to Christ, basically. And sure enough, there's Jehoshaphat, fourth king of Israel, or fourth king of Judah, excuse me, the southern kingdom. And then an Old Testament prophet, Jeremiah. So these will be our scriptural sources. And the intent in all of this is to penetrate more to the heart of the matter, not just content ourselves with overt, visible behavior. Okay, so when we're talking about addictions, it's easy to identify the behavior, you know, someone's drinking too much or whatever it is. But we ought to, and we need to, go beyond the surface and really drill down some to the heart of the matter, literally and figuratively. And so hopefully from this, we'll derive some very practical theology with regard to addictions, and you can help individuals who are struggling with addictions with some of this theology. You know, theology, do you believe theology should be practical? Yeah. How are we doing there, Paul?
We're getting there.
Okay. While he's setting up, this might be a good opportunity to start one of those questions, those discussion questions. How about the first question, as a result of your attendance in these classes, has your understanding of the factors that contribute to addictions changed? Anybody want to chime in there? Okay, I'll take that as a no. Yes. I see that hand in the back.
There's a lady who works at the hospital who's in hospice, and her husband had several years of cancer, and a person in her church had cancer. Their response to that was to get a bunch of food and champagne, and they went to that person's house, and they said, "We hear you're diagnosed with cancer. We're here to celebrate that because we know what God has for you in this journey." And I think one aspect of people who have addictions that are just right out there, in some ways whether they're food or alcohol or drugs, whatever it is, that such an overt behavior, I would celebrate with a Christian who says, this is my problem, and it's so consuming, saying, you know what? God, what you meant for evil, God is going to use for good. And it's God really works with that Christian, and there's a wonderful journey of saying no to that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So really, out of brokenness comes new strength. And the author, we're going to look at it shortly, Cusick, he said the day that he was found out, so to speak, it was the worst day of my life and the best day of my life. So I think that speaks to what you're saying. Some of the predisposing factors. Well, let's see. We're going to come back to these questions after we fly through the material. Okay, so that's our lineup of... where's Paul? Did he leave? Paul, did you do a spell check?
I did. How did you
Because this read theologican, and I was going to tell a quick story.
Was that part of the presentation?
Well, it was. I was going to make it part of the presentation, so I'll do it. I'll do it anyway. But he cleaned everything up. Oh well. But anyway, I have a nurse, and she's of Mexican descent. And whenever I ask her, "Can you do something?" she says, "Well, sure I can. I'm a Mexican." And so, This originally read theologican, and I was going to explain, well, a theologican is a theologian who can do it all. Yeah. So, Chesterton, Lewis. Now, of course, Lewis was more than a Christian apologist, but, and we've already said that. Okay, so now on to Chalmers' sermon. So what I'm going to do is give you three spiritual principles using these material from these authors. And so the first principle is this, and I apologize, this will be in the revised version of the notes. I didn't actually include the spiritual principles in the slides, but here it is, spiritual principle one, a new affection. And I derive that from Chalmers' famous sermon, The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. That was the title of his sermon, based on the text here, 1 John 2. Now, if you go back, you know, Pastor Rayburn has most of the sermons he's preached here archived, at least since we've had modern technology. And so I actually referenced that, and sure enough, he has preached on that, and he referenced this sermon, not surprisingly. So here's the thrust of the sermon, if I could distill it down for you. If you expect, you or whoever's dealing with an addiction, expect to root out a stubborn habitual sin, Hebrews 12:1 refers to it as a besetting sin, that will only happen if something or someone more appealing takes its place. So here's, this is Chalmers speaking to the Christian, really instructing the Christian on how to think about and how to talk to an individual who is struggling with a particular sin. He says, it is quite in vain to think of stopping one of these pursuits, and that's my insertion there, in any way else but by stimulating to another pursuit, that is. So try to follow his line of thought here. You have to encounter the pleasure which he feels in the very prosecution of them. That probably means execution. The pleasure. Now, we've said over and over that people don't get addicted to things they don't find pleasurable. And so here's that concept of pleasure. So don't deny that it's pleasurable. Acknowledge that. And from there, you must address to the eye of his mind another object with a charm powerful enough to dispossess the first of its influence and more alluring. So the application for us, speaking of addictions, no one will give up a deeply ingrained practice for a vacuum. People don't like walking into vacuums. It's not a comfortable place to be. There must be a new and more attractive affection. So does that make sense? Now, a little about Chalmers, and Rob mentions this in his sermon. Chalmers was a minister. He was an unsaved minister. We've heard about those types. And he, I guess you'd classify him as a moralist, you know, in the 19th century, and really bereft of true knowledge and concern for the gospel, until he had a near-death illness that was instrumental in his salvation. And thereafter, the love of the world, spoken of in 1 John 2:15, gave way to love of God and immortality. One parishioner said of his sermons after his conversion, "The world to come cast an awful shadow over every sermon." Now, I don't think he meant awful in the modern sense of the word. I think awful as an awe-inspiring. It was in that context that awful was a good thing. And then another parishioner John, noticed that he would visit him on occasion on a Saturday as he's preparing for the Sabbath message. And in the old days, before he was saved, he would give more attention to other subjects and, you know, maybe an hour or something to sermon preparation. It just wasn't a priority of his. And this fellow couldn't help but notice the change in Chalmers, and he said something to the effect, you're just consumed by your Bible reading and preparation for sermons. And Chalmers' response was this, "Too little, John, too little." Okay, so leaving Chalmers, we go to Chesterton, who said this interesting thing, "Every man who knocks on the door of a brothel is knocking for God." So I would propose a second spiritual principle relevant to addictions, and that is this, go beyond the visible, look to the heart. What you see is the guy knocking on the brothel door, seeking a prostitute, presumably, but what's really going on in his heart? Could it be that when one lusts after whatever, Beneath the visible action is the hidden heart's desire that is God-given and can only be satisfied by God. Doesn't that harken back to Augustine's famous, saying? The pursuit of empty pleasure is really a search for our heart's deepest... And this, by the way, is a direct quote from a book just released this month entitled Surfing for God, Discovering the Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Struggle by Michael Cusick. And I have not read the book, even though it is available now on Amazon and other places. But I've heard him interviewed by at least three different folk, and I like the material. I think that this very well could become a standard text, not the kind of text one would read, say, in a seminary, but something that could be used both by an addict and in helping other addicts, especially with regard to sexual sin. But anyway, he says, the pursuit of empty pleasure is really a search for our heart's deepest desire. And the real key to resistance to sin, that is discovering an even deeper passion. Kind of harkens back to Chalmers' sentiment. And here's, I just went online, this is Amazon, and you probably can't read these chapter titles, but some of these we've at least alluded to or talked about. He's chapter 2, it's not about sex. Remember I said that last week. Your brain on porn, etc. So check out that book. I don't think you'll be disappointed. Cancel. Paul, where's Paul? It won't let me do anything until we cancel that message.
A tune-up.
We need a tune-up, huh? Paul's not been getting his tune-ups, folks. How about that X by cancel? Will that do anything? Great. Woo! Okay, here we go. And get your tune-up, okay? Now, Cusick talks about three levels of accountability. This is good stuff. First, you have the cop. His role is just to enforce the law, the rule enforcer, and his motto is, I'm watching you. So do we need that? Well, sometimes, if we're speeding, I suppose, but in the spiritual life, it's not all that effective. And then you have the coach, and his role, of course, is to encourage, train and encourage. His motto, just work harder, I believe in you. If you fall down, have a relapse, to use the jargon of addictions. It's okay, pick yourself up, get going, stay in the game, that kind of thing. And then there's what he refers to as the cardiologist of the heart. Matthew 15:9, that passage is talking about the things that proceed out of the heart. And if you read that passage, they're not exactly good things mentioned there. And so his role is to be a spiritual dissector. So you can think of a cardiologist or a cardiac surgeon, I suppose, if we're going to be using a knife. And his motto is, let's take a look at your heart, the source of sin. Okay, so let's go below the surface here and try to understand what's really driving this behavior. And then that brings us to C.S. Lewis's quote from Screwtape Letters, an ever-increasing craving for an ever-diminishing pleasure. That's the formula Screwtape advises. And this brings us to spiritual principle number 3, which I would propose is the law of inverse proportionality. Now, scientists here, is that a mathematical... I suppose that's a mathematical law, maybe physics, I don't know. But there is a law of inverse proportionality. As one variable decreases, the other increases, okay? And so the application to addictions is, as one gets further into the addiction process, cravings increase and pleasure decreases. And isn't that exactly what Screwtape is instructing Wormwood in? How illustrative. Yeah. Was he addicted? No.
It's interesting as we look at addictions and particular sins and this balance of we live in a world that's so self-absorbed anyway, which really is a manifestation of these addictions, very, very self-absorbed, and we can also be trapped in our self-absorption and being free from addictions. C.S. Lewis, to my knowledge, never acknowledged or struggled at all with his nicotine addiction. That was not something that was even on his dance card. Uh-huh. And I'm wondering if you could comment on the balance of working on particular sins, but also not being so self-absorbed that we're always measuring our cumin and our cinnamon to the nth degree.
Mm-hmm. The best I would say to that is he was a man of his times, as we all are. Back then, nicotine was not considered harmful. In fact, as I've said in previous classes, physicians were used to advertise cigarettes, tobacco. So he, you know, he enjoyed the substance, again, the pleasure thing, but I don't think he and his cohorts at that time would have recognized the harm. So they would not have thought of it as an addiction, probably. Does that work for you?
I'm wondering if there's something that was actually kind of gained by them not focusing on it. That
you mean like lung cancer?
Yeah. Or something we lost that due to the fact that it wasn't addressed, he would have had some amazing insights on the whole topic if it became a point of struggle in his life. So, I don't know.
Yeah. So, to my way of thinking, that doesn't diminish him in any way in my mind, because I do try to understand him in terms of his time. And to take our values, including our health values, and project them back into that time, it doesn't always work.
Hey, Mark, I remember reading something about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I think he was in prison, and he got a hold of some cigarettes, I think, and he enjoyed that. I had the same kind of thought.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in prison, you probably needed a few enjoyments. Yeah.
It was interesting looking at the idea of addiction in light of all Christianity and how this is a particular thing that's very current in how we're addressing our Christianity. And it's interesting how it wasn't looked at that way. And I think some of that is we are incredibly self-focused.
Yes. Yes, I'll certainly grant you that. Now, here's the tragic irony behind all addictions. God delights in meeting our needs as only he can, and he has proven himself faithful to do so. I would suggest that the greatest of his provisions, his gift, is his everlasting love. Jeremiah 31:3, I have loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore, I have continued my faithfulness to you. But, a big but here, despite the reality of God's ever-reliable love, his mortal creatures, we, tend to seek fulfillment of our needs in all the wrong places. You know, the song, Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places. Who sang that, by the way? It was a Western. I think more than one person sang it, but anyway. And inevitably, the law of diminishing returns, or, to be consistent, that law of inverse proportionality, applies. Okay? Now, to the scriptural references. In Jeremiah 2, we have Jeremiah's first sermon, and in that, it's a great read. You've got to take a look at it on your leisure. Anyway, it's a condemnation of everybody, basically, the priests, the prophets, the leaders, the kings, and the people generally. Nobody escapes the rebuke here. The priests, you recall, the quote there, those who handle the law did not know me. The prophets prophesied by Baal. The rulers also transgressed against me. So, I mean, it's just boom, boom, boom. Nobody escapes. And, here in verse 4 and 5, what wrong did your fathers find in me that they went far from me? In other words, God says, you know, this ain't my fault, folks, the situation you're in. So don't blame me. I'm not the one that's strayed. It's you. And you have gone after worthlessness. I don't know any Hebrew, but I had in my margin in my Bible an idol there. So that the idea there is to seek after idols. Verse 11, has a nation changed its gods even though they are no gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. You know, even the heathen nations, they stick to the same old gods even though they do nothing. But not so with Israel. She was changing her gods. I mean, how foolish. They have the one God who can really do something and is real. Verse 13, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters. What beautiful language. and hewed out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water. I think if there's any scripture that speaks to addictions, this is it. So the remedy, please. The fundamental spiritual dynamic behind addictions is a forsaking of the fountain of living waters. Will you buy that? If that's so, then what's the remedy? Well, it's the same as for all sin, because addiction is simply a deeply ingrained pattern of sin, you know, the rutted type, or Hebrews 12:1, you know, the, what's the phrase there, the besetting sin, which the idea in Hebrews there is the sin that clings to you, that you can't, you know, rip off, so to speak. And this type of sin, it's not amenable to simple self-help measures, okay? So picking up the latest self-help book from the bookstore just ain't going to cut it, probably. So the first step, of course, is humbling yourself. And here the addict says, I have attempted to fulfill my needs in my own ways apart from God. I've botched it. And then acknowledgement of sin. Jeremiah 2:35 and Jeremiah 3:13 speak directly to this acknowledging of sin and acknowledging your need for forgiveness and healing. Okay, not just forgiveness, but healing. As Christians, you see, that's what Christians and Christianity, the gospel, offers true healing, forgiveness and healing. And then, this is sequential, continuing to come before the Lord in prayer and worship. And as an individual does that, that new affection, spoken of by Chalmers, displaces the old, and true freedom results. Remember, we subtitled this series, Setting the Captive Free. Well, there's the freedom. And God can then truly satisfy the heart's desire. And when that happens, then it's the law of direct proportionality. Okay, as you pour out your sinfulness, your brokenness, your whatever to God, he pours into you and pours into you and pours into you, and it becomes directly proportional, not inversely proportional. Okay? But the addict will say, yeah, Mark, I believe all that to be true because it's the word of God, but something's holding me back. And what's that something? Fear. And it can paralyze. You know, the addict can say things like, you don't know the grip this, you know, whatever the sin is or addiction is, has on me. You don't know the shame I carry. You don't know the many failures, the times I've sworn to quit, failed. You don't know the double life that I lead and what exposing that double life would do to me. You know, loss of marriage, loss of career, loss of reputation, et cetera, et cetera. So what is God's response to fear? Well, God knows we're prone to fear. You know, if you look at the Bible, how many fear nots do you find in the Bible? It's all throughout the Bible. Someone once counted them up and came up with 365. I think that's a little contrived myself, but, you know, if you want to do that research, go ahead. The point is, it's there a lot. God knows we need it, so he put it in there a lot. And here's a wonderful verse, Isaiah 41:13. For I, the Lord your God, hold your right hand. It is I who say to you, fear not, I am the one who helps you. Now, if we could just truly hear the voice of God say, fear not, that's all you need, friends. But other things, of course, can mute the voice of God. Now, on to 2 Chronicles chapter 20. The context here, you have three groups, the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Moonites, coming to make war. That's verse 1. And, I mean, in no uncertain terms, their intent is laid out right there. They are coming to make war. So take note, Judah. And so in the following verse, we see that Jehoshaphat was afraid and turned his attention to seek the Lord. Rightly so, they feared this great horde poised for attack. Now, the application for us is this. There is one thing and one thing only that you should fear, And that is the destruction that addiction can bring upon you apart from God's help. The addict early in the course of things doesn't believe that and doesn't want to believe that. They deny that. But eventually, if they do come to seek help, it's because they realize that destruction has already come upon them or is soon to come upon them. So what was Jehoshaphat's reaction? Say that name quickly 10 times, please. Well, we read that he set his face to seek the Lord in prayer. Wrong way. And then verse 12, he says to the people, "For we are powerless." This is in prayer to the Lord. "For we are powerless against this great horde. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are upon you." Would that more of our leaders today had that attitude. And then, while he's in prayer, interestingly not, the fear not message comes. Okay, here's one of those fear nots. Verse 15, "Listen, all Judah, thus says the Lord to you." So this isn't just to Jehoshaphat, it's to the whole people. "Do not be afraid, do not be dismayed at this great horde, for the battle is not yours, but God's." The application here, God says, briefly, "You show up for battle, I will fight for you." There is still a battle, that's the bad news, but the good news is victory is assured. And then a very interesting thing happens. It describes the worship. Jehoshaphat bowed his head with his face to the ground, and all Judah fell down before the Lord, worshiping. The Levites, the priestly order, stood up to praise the Lord God of Israel with a very loud voice. Now, it would be interesting to know what they said. And then the next verse, they rose early in the morning to go out to battle. And who did they put in the vanguard in front of this much smaller group? They put men in holy attire. It doesn't describe what the holy attire is, but we can imagine. And these men are singing or shouting or whatever, "Give thanks to the Lord, for his steadfast love endures forever." So this is what the oncoming army is seeing. And you can just imagine what they're thinking. Oh, this is a rout. it's kind of like, David and Goliath. It's like, get out of my way, you puny David. I'm Goliath. But what happens? It's a rout, but it's a rout in favor of God's people, right? And they took spoils for 3 days, it says. I mean, not everybody was wiped out. And they wiped themselves out, I think I read. They turn on each other for some strange reason. And they end up killing each other off. And the people of God don't even have to, throw a stone or shoot a arrow or whatever. Okay. Now, a few negative examples we can derive from Jehoshaphat quickly. He did make some poor alliances. We don't have time to dwell on this, but he snuggled up too closely with a couple kings from the north, these guys, Ahab and Ahaziah, and not so good things to derive from that. The application for us and for the addict: choose your friends wisely. The addict needs new playmates in a new playground. That's what I tell my patients, at least. And then, the Fab Five. I don't know what phone company has that Fab Five thing, but you got to get your old contacts out and put some new ones in there. My mother-in-law, I know this because my wife told me this. She had a saying in Spanish: "Dígame con quién andas y yo te diré quién eres." Tell me with whom you walk, and I will tell you who you are. And then the other negative example we can learn from Jehoshaphat's life is that of incomplete parting with sinful practices. We know that he rid Judah of the cult of male prostitutes, but he did not completely rid the country of the high places. And we've heard that message time and time again when Rob was preaching through Kings. So the application here is, I take this from Lord of the Rings, release the ring, my precious, into the fire of Mount Doom. Reluctance to do so almost killed Frodo. Remember when he was on the precipice and that struggle that he had? Got to let it go. Okay, to our discussion questions. I think we already did this one. Oh, we were about to do this one. What are some of the predisposing factors? Factors that contribute to the development of addictions. This is review now.
Genetics
would be part of it, certainly. Family of origin issues, possibly abuse. Now, here's one I didn't mention, but I'll throw it out for your consideration. The majority of cases probably are the, you know, the bad families, the abusive. What's happening, Paul?
I don't know what that does either.
Okay. But consider this. Sometimes we see families of origin where it may even be a Christian family or just some family that has a lot of structure. And it could be very tight, very authoritative, very structured, and everything's a do not kind of approach, you know, just don't do that because that's sinful, you know. And then the child grows up, adolescence, leaves the home, and they all of a sudden they have all this newfound freedom, and they just go hog wild. I think you've all seen or know examples of that. So it's not always, you know, the person's coming from a really messed up family, unless you want to consider that type of family messed up. But you get the point. It can happen even when you're in a Christian home if it's especially restrictive or authoritarian. So, as a result of these classes, has your attitude towards the addict changed?
Yes, because I had the idea that I knew that they were enslaved by the substance or the addiction. But when you talked about looking at what the core, what's causing them to go to this substance, their lifestyle. You told of a woman who looked to be in her midlife, and yet she was much younger. And when you learned of her upbringing and her lifestyle, no wonder, you said.
Uh-huh.
And that's made me a lot more sympathetic toward these people. And I shared with you, my friend's daughter is battling a terrible battle, and she has multiple things in her background that she's trying to camouflage or get over, and she can't. And this is what's helping.
Mm-hmm.
So it helped me be a lot more understanding.
More understanding. Thank you. Yeah, it helps us if we not think of like we and them, but really of us. Okay, I think I shared this with you. When I first started doing addiction medicine, I sent out an email to my physicians just to informing them and saying, you know, I'm here if your patients need any help in this. And one of my physician colleagues, emailed me back and said, basically, I don't want to have anything to do with this, and insinuated it was just going to attract the dregs of society to our clinic. And my response was, the dregs of society were going to come, you know, the heroin addicts were going to, you know, come land in our clinic. And my response was simply, these are already in your practice. These are your patients. You know, they is us. So to make, you know, that distinction is not helpful.
Maybe you should have said the dregs of society already work here.
Yeah, we employ them. we is them.
Yeah, we're all addicts.
Yeah.
And the question is what idols have we chosen?
Yeah. Yeah, if you think of addiction really as idolatry, yeah, we're all addicts. Right. And so, you know, this, and getting back to the terminology, you know, I think in week 2 or 3, we talked about the phraseology and terminology. A lot of this terminology is modern stuff. You know, if we get back to the biblical ancient terminology, yeah, then we see that the playing field gets very leveled, doesn't it?
Mark, as a physician, what would you say, as you've worked with so many different people through the years with addictions, what can the church, what is the body supposed to be doing, especially this particular body that we're not doing? One thing that hit me when you had your couple slides ago and said something about it's not just about forgiveness, it's about forgiveness and healing. And I think that we get to a certain point and then we just drop them off at that station, so to speak. We don't finish the process with our brothers and sisters who need to go much further through the healing process. Or we refer them someplace else, is what I'm saying. We source out.
Right. It's a big challenge. Now, some larger churches, you know, your mega churches, they can do more of the counseling and these things. But so the answer is not for everybody to become a megachurch, obviously. But longitudinality is very key with addictions, because if you just assume that someone is, and this gets to the question of, this is kind of what I was getting at here, when is it appropriate to speak of an addict as being cured or healed? Well, you know, when are we sinless? Not in this life. So when are you free of potential relapse into an addiction? It's always there. Okay, so it's better, I think, to think of the biblical concept of salvation as a progressive or sanctification. This is a work in progress. And so, yeah, just because the addict has come forward and you know, acknowledged their problem and they're no longer actively pursuing that, that ain't the end of the road. And so the church, whatever it looks like in the church, and it's going to look differently in different churches based on, you know, resources and whatnot. But that's the key thing. You have to have a long-term view of this, okay? And it's okay to resource out, okay? Sometimes that's the most appropriate thing. We have to recognize that, you know, the church cannot be all things to all people, but we do want it to be the first recourse, okay? People shouldn't be running away from the church because they fear they're going to be judged or whatever. You know, this should be a good starting point at least. And
Mark, why can't the church be all people? Why can't you have a church of 10 people or 10,000 people? Why can't you minister to those people in your group, in your church, or that your church has contact with?
You need to at least have a preventative atmosphere where if people are headed in a direction personally, they feel like they can be open and find the help they need at their church to prevent that. Or, I mean, like, cognitively, don't they know if they're going in the wrong direction? And they might even weekly cry out for help, but if they can't find that help ahead of time, it's going to be much harder and worse down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, they might find it afterwards, go get outsourced or whatever, but
yeah,
they're going to be hurt by the body they're in. They didn't feel like they were supportive.
Yeah. What we want to do, what any church really needs to be thinking of and doing, is creating an environment where people can admit their need and their
Paul is saying, and you too, in your clinic, yeah, you're not inviting threads in. We've got them in the church.
Yeah. Yes, in the back.
Let me just suggest broadening our thinking about how we approach addictions, and let me just throw this out as an example. I want you to think about...
We prefer to be narrow-minded, I'm sorry.
That's my default. Think about this congregation's and others in the Presbytery of Pacific Northwest, but largely the impetus comes from this congregation initially. In the ministry that is at Sacred Grove on the Yakima Reservation. That is a ministry that is designed to, of course, evangelize the native peoples there in that nation. But it is largely focused on battling directly the addictions that exist in a very overt form on the reservation. It is right there in front of your face all the time. Addictions to caregivers, addictions to alcohol and drugs. And the focus of that ministry is largely on the children of the next generation, humanly speaking, rescuing those children from the addictions, the new parents in the world. So think about, you know, what it means to have Chris Granberry driving a van around Toads Park, picking up children at 4 o'clock in the afternoon for Bible study.
Yeah, this is not a theoretical consideration for that ministry.
It's a form of battling addiction, but it is not the form we would typically think of, or the program we would typically think about battling addiction. But it is very much about it.
Well, I would, if we were to talk to Chris about this, he would probably say, you know, foundationally, we are emphasizing relationships, building relationships. You have to get them to trust you, and then they'll listen to you. You can describe a better way of living. Did you want to expand on that some more?
No.
Okay. Yeah, well, thank you for pointing that out. I mean, we have a very significant work in our presbytery on the reservation. And so I'm sure that will have spillover effects in our churches, don't you think? Yeah.
Isn't there a fine line between starting up some professional counseling within the church and the professions of the people, with various gifted people have in professions? Can't have all the counseling sessions going on outside of the church, so...
So what's, I'm sorry, what's the question? Is there a question?
There's a fine line between having people counsel for certain addictions professionally or within the church, people just doing it for, volunteer, because they do that.
Mm-hmm.
Sir.
Go ahead.
I know of two churches that have the program Celebrate Recovery. And like you said, AA goes so far, but it doesn't really get into the spiritual aspect where Celebrate Recovery does. And the church we left had a very large program, and it was very effective. And they had recovery from anywhere from pornography down to anger. And it really, we heard of a young man who came back to the Lord through that ministry and also helped his addiction. So that could be, and then there's a church in Lake Chelan, a little Bible church, went by on a Monday night, and there was a sign that said, Celebrate Recovery Monday night. You should have seen the parking lot. It was full. So that would be an avenue.
Yeah, and those are used, thank you, those are usually cooperative endeavors, several churches. I know the one in on the peninsula that you're referring to, even though it's housed there at Chapel Hill, other churches are part of that. And they have a pretty full parking lot, too, there. Yeah.
I guess I'd give you the opportunity to clarify here, but I think some of our discussion about what the church can do for itself has sort of watered down what I thought you were very careful to say, which is addiction is this and such, and not everybody who is healing, who is an idolater, is an addict. We are, relatively few of us are addicts, but we all sin in various ways. So, the church has a ministry to us all, but if we're talking about addiction, that ministry would be to a few. So, are we watering down what is an addict, or are we?
I don't think so. As I see it, I mean, the label addict is a subset of sinner, okay, and it's one who has lost control in a particular area, okay, and that activity, sinful behavior, whatever you want to call it, really is dominating their life. And
there's a flip side to this. Us people that haven't experienced these deep problems and are just kind of living a routine Christian life, we're in danger too of a different type of sin and complacency. And I guess just because to me, I think about this a lot, but just to give you an example, I befriended a girl once that had the most bizarre problems that I could never imagine. I mean, like, what planet is she off of, And through the years, just sticking with her, being her friend, not trying to evangelize her or anything, just being there for her, praying with her, whatever. And as life changed, she became better and more healed. She gained strength from the Christian community. I could see her progressing. And then I hit a point in my life where I was struggling, and then all of a sudden, I started learning from what she went through. I even experienced some of the same things that happened to her. And I thought how interesting that God would put this woman in my life. So what I'm saying is, don't think of yourself above that person that you're trying to minister to. And you have to realize that that's our calling as Christians. We need to connect one-on-one with someone. You pray about who that is that God puts in front of you. I mean, the pastor's wife can't minister to all the women in the church. She has heart to, but it's going to wear her out. And there needs to be more women that would be true friends. And when someone calls and says, I need to pray, I'm having a hard day, or you know, let's get together with coffee, or you know, how do you love your husband better? I'm really mad at him. I mean, just get down to nuts and bolts. You know, I'm having a hard time submitting with submission. You know, I just can't keep going this way, or whatever the issue is that a woman may be going through. You know.
Yeah, again, it gets back to a friendship, a relationship.
And I admit, I must be a really weak Christian because I've really struggled with depression in a deep way in my life. And a lot of times when I'm trying to reach out and find that one person that will help me through to pray with me and just get down to reality, I get this sense of we're too busy, we're homeschooling, we got to stay on our schedule. They don't have time. And I think that's something we really need to think about as routine Christians.
Yeah, most of us have not structured any free time into our lives to make ourselves available if a need arises like this. A crack open, I like that, yeah.
I think it's in Schaefer's True Spirituality, I don't remember the book anyway, to talk about when he first went to Switzerland, you know, at least in small villages, the women would meet at the fountain to do their laundry and to wash their clothes and stuff. He thought that was very good because people were getting together and talking.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, our lives are can be very separate now. We do all our stuff. I talk to anybody at all.
Yeah, and you know, just by raising the topic, it's helpful. I remember last year when John Freeman and his colleague came, spoke to us and to the presbytery. You know, between meetings, John was being approached by ministers saying, gee, you know, this is happening in my church and whatnot. And but people don't like to and normally don't talk about those things, but that created an occasion. But, yeah, the meeting at the well, that's a whether it's a meeting of the presbytery or a meeting at the well, we have to meet and be willing to share our lives. So let me just go through this in the needing glass questions. Resources, I've mentioned Ed Welch's book. That's a very good one. The sermon, you can get that online. It's a good read. And then this book, Surfing for God. Again, I haven't read it, but it promises to be very good. And then final thought, since we're talking about layers of sin. Oh, that day when freed from sinning. This is, by the way, the final stanza of Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. I shall see thy lovely face, clothed then in blood-washed linen. How I'll sing thy sovereign grace. Come, my Lord, no longer tarry. Take my ransomed soul away. Send thine angels now to carry me to realms of endless day. So if I forget to tell my wife, would you all include that in my funeral if I die before you do?
I have a friend who's very deeply involved in AA, right, and is, like, not addicted to it, but it feels like he has to go because of the relationships and the power that other people have over them, her in particular, and that at what point, you know, does it have to be an endless, lifelong, you know, participation in that type of thing, where this person wants to be is a Christian, but then also, you know, creates a dichotomy in her life between this group and true spirituality and melding these together. And is it going to be something that goes on and on and on endlessly? Or, to the question of can you be cured or healed? You never really cured or healed or sinless. But does it have to, you know, until the day you die, you know, go to it?
So the question, thank you, the question really gets to the utility or the need, ongoing need for something like AA. And I gave a handout on AA, kind of the pros and cons several weeks back. My take on that is as I studied the AA, and I'd never actually attended AA, so I feel like I don't have much of a right to criticize, but I have talked to enough of my patients who do attend, and on whole, I'm a supporter of that, but if that becomes your only fellowship, you're missing the boat, okay? That is not intended to be your church or anyone's church. You know, we all have a lifetime need for the Church of Christ, okay? So yeah, week after week, that's where we should be plugged in. Now, the individual who has benefited from AA, do they need to continue to attend AA for the rest of their life? Well, probably not. But if they want to and be a blessing to other alcoholics or addicts, that's fine, because a lot of the emphasis is on service. And so someone needs to be there who has the sobriety to help others who are coming in, you know, just you know, fresh, you know. Yes.
I just wanted to say to that. I think my husband and I work in
Very well stated. I think that's a legitimate criticism or observation with a little criticism in there. If the shoe fits, wear it. Yeah, we're out of time. I'm sorry, but if you have any additional questions, certainly email me. Thanks for your interest in attendance.